Welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from Religion News Service, from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, and more. This week's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from Religion News Service dated October 31st, and this is related to a new movie that was released last weekend about the life of Harriet Tubman. And the headline on this article is Harriet Tubman in Movie and Real Life, Guided by Faith in Fight for Freedom. This is by Adele M. Banks of Religion News Service. God don't mean people to own people. That simple statement, uttered by Cynthia Erivo in the title role of Harriet, a new movie about Harriet Tubman, reveals a truth long known by scholars of the woman dubbed Moses. Tubman's lived religion has been well recorded and used to explain how in 1849, a Maryland 20-something slave, in parentheses her exact birth date is not known, set out for the North to freedom, then over the next 10 years helped dozens of others gain liberty from enslavement. She embraced faith instead of fear, said Kate Clifford Larson, a historical consultant for the movie. It gave her confidence to do the things that she did, said Larson. She felt so guided and protected by her God, her faith, her everything spiritual, that that's what enabled her to act even when she was afraid, even when the obstacles seemed insurmountable. Her faith gave her that strength to keep moving even though she was afraid. Harriet, which opened Friday, November 1st, details how her heroism was wedded to her lifelong religious beliefs. When the movie opens, we're in church, said Vanessa Bell Calloway, who portrayed Rit Ross, Tubman's mother, in the film. When we are introducing Harriet, she is a spiritual person, because that's the way she was raised. The character of Tubman's faith is not entirely clear. At the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad State Park in Church Creek, Maryland, an exhibit notes that Tubman's spirituality drew from both African and Christian customs. What is not in doubt is the strength of her faith, which she seems to have inherited from her deeply religious parents, who are known to have fasted on Fridays. In the movie, Tubman's father, portrayed by Clark Peters, is so committed to speaking the truth that he wears a blindfold when his daughter briefly returns home, depriving himself of seeing his daughter so he can honestly say he has not seen her. He did do that, confirmed Larson, author of Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero, of the real life Ben Ross. That was reported in interviews way back. As the nation has marked the 400th anniversary of enslaved Africans being forcibly brought to Virginia, Harriet, which was filmed entirely in Virginia, shows the religious practice of slaves forced to work on Maryland plantations was as restricted as other aspects of their lives. They were only able to see each other once a week on Sunday, said Karen Hill, president and CEO of the Harriet Tubman Home Incorporated in Auburn, New York. She knew that they didn't have total and complete freedom, and whatever faith they practiced was under the aegis of their slave masters, added Hill, a member of the AME Zion Church, where descendants of slaves have helped maintain Tubman's home for more than a century. She knew that she could not really practice her faith until she was truly free. The contradictions of faith and slavery are brought to life in the Reverend Samuel Green, a black minister portrayed in the movie by Vondi Curtis Hall, who recites Bible verses encouraging slave obedience. Larson noted that Green may have preached what the slave owners wanted to hear, but he also was a very good Underground Railroad station master, she said, noting that scholars have documented that he helped at least 25 people escape. Green also advised Tubman in her work for liberty. Fear is your enemy. Trust in God, Green tells Tubman as she plans her solo escape in the movie. When Green was brought to trial for his work on the Underground Railroad, the all-white jury acquitted him because he's so well-respected, said Larson. But then they brought him up on charges of owning a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was illegal for African Americans to have in Maryland at the time. Tubman's one-time pastor was sentenced to 10 years in prison for owning the book. Some of the people who worked most closely with Tubman as she focused on her freedom campaign could not help but notice how faith was the principal driver of everything she did, said Hill. I never met with any person of any color who had more confidence in the voice of God, as spoken direct to her soul, and her faith in a supreme power truly was great, reads an 1868 quote from Quaker abolitionist Thomas Garrett on the wall of an exhibit at the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad State Park. Her faith also had a mystical side. When Tubman was about 13, she was struck in the head by an iron weight thrown by an overseer who was trying to catch a runaway slave, but hit Tubman instead, leaving her with an enduring head injury. When she'd have her seizures, she would hear voices. She would have premonitions, said Larson. She had a lot of visual hallucinations, but she tied them deeply to messages from God. Though she could not read or write, Tubman relied on memorization and depended on her belief in what she felt God was telling her to do. She had an amazing memory, said Larson, who said Tubman recounted aspects of her life in interviews after the Civil War, during which she spied for the Union Army and worked as a nurse and a combat leader. She could remember Bible passages and things like that, and people would read to her all the time, but she never learned to read. Though the movie dwells on Tubman as a slave and slave rescuer, Hill said she hopes the film will move viewers to investigate more of her life as a free woman. Faith played a role then, too, Hill noted, in Tubman's worship, financial support, and 1913 funeral at what is now known as Thompson Memorial AME Zion Church in Auburn. She also worked to provide free medical aid to blacks and whites and opened the Harriet Tubman Home for the Aged, where she eventually spent her last days. She communed with God, but then she used all her mind, body, and soul to carry out what God had directed her to do, said Hill. Her faith meant that she had to seek freedom in every aspect of daily living of humanity. Harriet could contribute to uncovering the complex person whose work, as Frederick Douglass noted when writing to Tubman in 1868, was necessarily cloaked in secrecy. I have had the applause of the crowd and the satisfaction that comes of being approved by the multitude, he wrote to Tubman. Well, the most that you have done has been witnessed by a few trembling, scarred, and footsore bondmen and women, whom you have let out of the house of bondage, and whose heartfelt God bless you has been your only reward. Our next article this week is from the October 30th edition of the New York Times, and it's an opinion piece, and it's one that we probably wouldn't be able to read if not for the time of year, and it was published a day before Halloween. And the title of this article is The Magic of Linus and the Great Pumpkin. And you might be wondering why that's on a religion program, but I think you'll really enjoy this look at the Peanuts characters through the eyes of the famous Great Pumpkin cartoon. This is an article by Rich Cohen, who's listed as the author of The Last Pirate of New York, and this essay was adapted from the anthology The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. Pop culture can feel like religion when you're a kid, a shared set of heroes and poses, attitudes, moods, and jokes. For my father, who was born in 1933, it was a tone set by the two Franks, Sinatra and Capra. In my formative years, which ran from the mid-1970s to the mid-80s, my general outlook on life, though fueled by David Letterman and Bruce Springsteen, was anchored by Peanuts, the world drawn by the cartoonist Charles Schulz. It was Lucy, Linus, and Charlie Brown, a Job who suffered to soothe our suffering. It was a faith related via parable, the classic text being the 1966 TV special, It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. The imagery and music were what first drew me to the show, which I encountered in rebroadcasts. Here in the age of Kojak was a planet made for kids, a planet without school and without parents, where the leaves of autumn turn into the sort of phantasmagoria experienced when you get too close to the paste. But it was the story that held me. Next to its predecessor, A Charlie Brown Christmas, which culminates in the transcendent moment when Linus recites the Annunciation to the shepherds from the Gospel of Luke, The Great Pumpkin might seem less profound, yet the show is the purest parable of faith I know. You believe it not because it makes sense, but because it's ridiculous. The show's producer, Lee Mendelson, and the director, Bill Melendez, built the special around an oddball of a comic strip Schulz had written years before. In that strip, Linus, an artist and the most sensitive of the Peanuts gang, in parentheses, and who carries a security blanket as a preacher carries a Bible, writes a letter asking for succor from the Great Pumpkin, as another might ask for succor from Santa or Jesus. Linus seems to be the only one in his group of friends who is a believer and seeks to achieve a state of perfect sincerity. Variations of this word are used several times. Laia seeks the most sincere pumpkin patch to serve as his version of Gethsemane, the garden outside Jerusalem where Jesus prayed on the night of his arrest. Linus believes his faith will be rewarded in the hours before dawn by a visit from the great pumpkin. The figure will hover over the patch as God hovered over the waters. In parentheses, each year the great pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch he thinks is the most sincere, Linus explains. It's his faith that makes Linus a laughingstock, a figure of pity and contempt. If you believe deeply in anything, you become vulnerable and look foolish. And that, to me, is what the great pumpkin is about, the passion of Linus Van Pelt, degradation and humiliation, refusal to submit. The story opens with death and resurrection. Linus carries home a pumpkin, which his sister Lucy cuts in guts, causing him to scream, "I didn't know you were going to kill it!" A festival meant to end with the ascent of the great pumpkin has begun with the execution of a regular pumpkin. Linus is mocked as he writes to the great pumpkin, "Everyone tells me you're a fake, but I believe in you. P.S. If you really are a fake, don't tell me. I don't want to know." When Lucy and the others go off to trick-or-treat, Linus enters the wilderness of the pumpkin patch, where he will spend the night in a kind of prayer seeking to achieve the kind of honest belief that will summon the spirit. Only Sally joins him, but her motive is not pure. She is doing it for the object of her affection, Linus, while Linus is doing it for his God. In the end, she too betrays him, leaving him chattering in the cold, waiting for what will never arrive. Lucy retrieves her brother at 4 a.m., leads him home, and puts him to bed. In one of the most tender moments ever captured on TV, she takes off his socks, for only when the feet are free can the spirit rest. Though Linus has been disappointed and his God has not risen, he sleeps the sleep of the righteous. It's the same sleep as that of the fisherman at the end of The Old Man and the Sea. He's spent, and the sharks have devoured the marlin, but the prize was never the catch. It was the quest, the effort, and the suffering. In the final scene, Charlie Brown tries to console Linus about his wasted night in the pumpkin patch by saying, "I did a lot of stupid things in my life, too." This enrages Linus, who vows to find an even more sincere pumpkin patch next year. Experience is no match for faith. For many viewers, the special might offer a pagan vision. Scholz himself, who taught Sunday school and clearly drew on Christianity in constructing the scenario, in parentheses, Gethsemane, death and resurrection, didn't shy away from this interpretation. As described in David McAllis's biography, Scholz and Peanuts, the artist once responded to a letter writer by agreeing with her assertion that the great pumpkin was sacrilegious. His intent, he wrote, was to use the pumpkin deity as a metaphor for Santa Claus. John Updike dismissed the great pumpkin as travesty, if not blasphemy. "Not long ago, I came across a sermon online that used the special to demonstrate the fate of those who worship false gods. Linus follows a nature god instead of Jesus, and look where it leaves him, chattering alone in the cold." According to the sermon, Linus's belief is one of the most common beliefs about religion. It does not matter what a person believes in. As long as they are sincere in their belief, the object of their faith is irrelevant, and the faith is legitimate. Because the great pumpkin never shows, Scholz simply and brilliantly communicates sincerity is worthless if the object of faith is false. But to me, the sincerity in the great pumpkin is key, and is what has drawn me to its magic year after year. It's what you believe, but also the sincerity of that belief that can give your life meaning. Sincere belief can order an otherwise formless succession of days, and it is meaningful days, collected together, that add up to a meaningful life. We continue on Religion in the News with a column from the Washington Post dated October 27th. This is by Post columnist Christine Emba, and the title of this column, "Why Millennials Are Skipping Church and Not Going Back." Here are a few things we've learned about millennials this month. We don't have time to relax or think, but we do like to sleep. We're less interested in television than our parents, and after destroying vacations, weddings, car commuting, and other traditional activities in a well-publicized rampage, we have turned our attention to the basilicas. Or rather, away from them. Apparently, we've stopped going to church. The data comes from the findings of two surveys released this month. Analyzing 2017 data from the American Time Use Survey, economist Michelle Freeman of the Bureau of Labor Statistics found that while millennials are more highly educated and spend more time working than their older counterparts, they've stepped back dramatically from religious activities. At the Pew Research Center, studies tracking America's religious landscape found that although religious beliefs and practice have been declining at a rapid pace for people of all ages, the drop-off has been most pronounced among people ages 23 to 38. In 2019, roughly two-thirds attend worship services a few times a year or less, and 4 in 10 say they seldom or never go. A decade ago, it was more than half and only 3 in 10, respectively. Some of this might strike you as not so shocking. Millennials are entering their prime working years. They've got to make their way, climb their ladders, pay down all that student loan debt somehow. So what if they don't have as much time for what the surveys call civic and religious engagement right now? Most of us tend to believe in the life cycle effect. Yes, people may drift away from their church or temple or congregation when they're young, but they tend to come back when they have kids and things settle down. Except that's not what's happening either. Millennials are leaving religion, especially Christianity, and they're not going back. What to make of this latest deviation? First, there's the discomforting reminder that millennials aren't as young as they used to be. Being born from 1981 to 1996 means that at the upper end, some of us are 38 years old. By then, you could be on your second husband and third career. Also, we may have killed Toys R Us, but we're still having families. 30% of us now have children under the age of 6. It's just that we're not drifting back into worshiping or volunteering. But then again, so what? Will it matter for anyone other than the Sunday ushers whose collection baskets have suddenly gotten lighter? Yes, actually. Religious and other civic organizations will atrophy, and not just from lack of funds. Faith and practice can't persevere throughout our generation without attendance, and neither can the hope they tend to bring. And while that may not seem like a problem now, it will soon. We still want relationships and transcendence to be part of something bigger than ourselves. Our drive for those things isn't likely to wane, despite how ambivalent we might feel about ancient liturgies or interminable coffee hours or even pastors whose politics have taken a sharp turn MAGA-wards. Some of us are turning to convenient low-commitment substitutes for faith and fellowship. Astrology, the easy spiritualism of yoga and self-care, posting away on Twitter and playing more games. In parentheses, yes, literal games. The BLS survey found that we're nearly twice as likely to get our game on than non-millennials, and for a longer time. But then again, we're the World of Warcraft generation. Here's what really worries me. Few of these activities are as geared toward building deep relationships and communal support as the religious traditions the millennials are leaving behind. Actively participating in a congregation means embedding oneself in a community. This involves you in the lives of others and the other way around, their joys and sadnesses, connections, and expectations. By leaving religion, we're shrugging off the ties that bind, not just loosening them temporarily. Which is freeing in some sense. Finally, no one's breathing down my neck about finding a spouse. Until it's not. Much of the conversation around millennials today does center on workload and debt, but it's our generation's complaints about relationship culture, family formation, and a lack thereof that are likely to reach a crescendo in the coming years. Dating apps were exciting in 2012, but 7 years later were burnt out. A new wave of egg-freezing startups is targeting the growing number of millennial women who still haven't found the partner they hoped they would. In longer-range studies, researchers are also seeing that millennials are busier but also much less lonely. Perhaps as a result, we're having much less sex, attributable to fewer long-term relationships, exactly the sorts of tie-ups that used to be fostered by churches and civic organizations. The Pew and BLS surveys are MRIs for the soul. They give a snapshot of busy millennial life that many will easily attribute to our phase of life. But while phases pass, the underlying needs and wants will continue to matter. What happens when sleeping, working, and gaming more than our elders begins to make less sense? If we're closing the church doors behind us, we'll have to find somewhere else to tend to our spirits and our hearts. Next on Religion in the News, we'll return to the commentary section of the New York Times for an article published on, or a column rather, published on October 31st. This is the column is titled, Caring About Climate Change is the Christian Thing to Do. The subheadline, Global Warming Will Strike Hardest Against the Very People We're Told to Love, the Poor and Vulnerable. And this column is written by Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, who is a professor and co-director of the Climate Center at Texas Tech University. I'm a climate scientist. I'm also an evangelical Christian, and I'm Canadian, which is why it took me so long to realize the first two things were supposed to be entirely incompatible. I grew up in a Christian family with a science teacher dad who taught us that science is the study of God's creation. If we truly believe that God created this amazing universe, bringing matter and energy to life out of a formless, empty void of nothing, then how could studying his creation ever be in conflict with his written word? I chose what to study precisely because of my faith, because climate change disproportionately affects the poor and vulnerable, those already most at risk today. To me, caring about and acting on climate was a way to live out my calling to love others as we've been loved ourselves by God. I realized, distantly, that there were people on both sides who fundamentally believed and were even dedicated to promoting the idea that faith and science were in conflict. But it wasn't until I'd moved to the United States for graduate school that it dawned on me, to my disbelief, that divisions within the science-faith arena, originally focused on questions of human origins and the age of the universe, were expanding to include climate change. Now, this discrepancy is pointed out to me nearly every day, often by people with Bible verses in their social media profiles who accuse me of spreading Satan's lies, or sometimes by others who share my concerns about climate change but wonder why I bother talking to those people. The attacks I receive come via email, Twitter, Facebook comments, phone calls, and even handwritten letters. I track them all, and I've noticed two common denominators in how most of the authors choose to identify themselves. First, as political conservatives, no matter what country they're from, and second, in the United States, as conservative Christians, because the label evangelical has itself been co-opted as shorthand for a particular political ideology these days. But I refuse to give it up because I am a theological evangelical, one of those who can be simply defined as someone who takes the Bible seriously. This stands in stark contrast to today's political evangelicals, whose statement of faith is written first by their politics and only a distant second by the Bible, and who, if the two conflict, will prioritize their political ideology over theology. I'm not a glutton for punishment, and I don't thrive on conflict, so why do I keep talking about climate change to people who are disengaged or doubtful? Because I believe that evangelicals who take the Bible seriously already care about climate change, in parentheses, although they may not realize it. Climate change will strike hard against the very people we're told to care for and love, amplifying hunger and poverty, and increasing risks of resource scarcity that can exacerbate political instability, and even create or worsen refugee crises. Then there's pollution, biodiversity loss, habitat fragmentation, species extinction. Climate change makes all these worse, too. In fact, if we truly believe we've been given responsibility for every living thing on this planet, in parentheses, including each other, as it says in Genesis 1, then it isn't only a matter of caring about climate change. We should be at the front of the line demanding action. But if caring about climate change is such a profoundly Christian value, then why do surveys in the United States consistently show white evangelicals and white Catholics at the bottom of those Americans concerned about the changing climate? It turns out it's not where we go to church, in parentheses or don't, that determines our opinion on climate. It's not even our religious affiliation. Hispanic Catholics are significantly more likely than other Catholics to say the earth is getting warmer, according to a 2015 survey, and they have the same pope. It's because of the alliance between conservative theology and conservative politics that has been deliberately engineered and fostered over decades of increasingly divisive politics on issues of race, abortion, and now climate change, to the point where the best predictor of whether we agree with the science is simply where we fall on the political spectrum. An important and successful part of that framing has been to cast climate change as an alternate religion. This is sometimes subtle, as the church sign that reads, "On Judgment Day you'll meet Father God, not Mother Earth." Other times this point is made much more blatantly, like when Senator Ted Cruz of Texas told Glenn Beck in 2015 that climate change is not a science, it's a religion. Or when Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said at a 2014 event hosted by the Council on Foreign Relations that the problem is Al Gore's turned this thing into a religion. Why is this framing so effective? Because some 72% of people in the United States already identify with a specific religious label, according to a recent survey by the Pew Research Center. And if you are a Christian, you know what to do when a false prophet comes along preaching a religion that worships the created rather than the creator. Reject it. So this framing plays right into the narrative that scientists are a godless bunch who have teamed up with liberals, in parentheses, and perhaps the Antichrist, according to some comments I've received, to rule the world and overthrow religion, an agenda that any right-minded believer will oppose until his or her dying breath. In fact, 51% of scientists said in a 2009 Pew survey that they believed in God or a universal spirit or higher power. And that's why my favorite question is the one I often hear from fellow Christians. Do you believe in climate change? One of the first times I remember being asked this way was by a visitor to the evangelical church I attended here in Texas, who was surprised and possibly a little horrified to learn that the pastor's wife was a climate scientist. "No, I don't," I cheerfully replied. A puzzled silence ensued. Wary of calling out the pastor's wife, the man haltingly asked, "But didn't you just say you study climate science?" "That's right," I said with an encouraging nod. "So how can you not believe in it?" he asked, perplexed. And with that question, he opened the door to an incredibly constructive conversation about science, faith, and truth. As I always do now when someone asks this, I explain that climate change is not a belief system. We know that the Earth's climate is changing thanks to observations, facts, and data about God's creation that we can see with our eyes and test with the sound minds that God has given us. And still more fundamentally, I went on to explain why it matters. Because real people are being affected today, and we believe that God's love has been poured in our hearts to share with our brothers and sisters here and around the world who are suffering. After hundreds, even thousands of such conversations, I've grown to understand how much of this opposition to the idea that the climate is changing, that humans are responsible, that the impacts are serious, and the time to act is now, comes from fear. Fear of loss of our way of life, fear of being told that our habits are bad for society, fear of changes that will leave us worse off, fear of siding with those who have no respect for our values and beliefs. But as a Christian, I believe that the solution to this fear lies in the same faith that many non-Christians wrongly assume drives our rejection of the science. In the Apostle Paul's letter to Timothy, he reminds us that we have not been given a spirit of fear. Fear is not from God. Instead, we've been given a spirit of power to act rather than to remain paralyzed in anxiety, fear, or guilt. A spirit of love to have compassion for others, particularly those less fortunate than us, the very people most affected by a changing climate, and a sound mind to use the information we have to make good decisions. And you know what? These are the very tools we need to address climate change. By beginning with what we share and then connecting the dots between that value and a changing climate, it becomes clear about how caring for this planet and every living thing on it is not somehow antithetical to who we are as Christians, but rather central to it. Being concerned about climate change is a genuine expression of our faith, bringing our attitudes and actions more closely into line with who we already are and what we most want to be. And that's why I'm more convinced now than ever that the two most central parts of my identity, that of climate scientist and evangelical Christian, aren't incompatible. They are what's made me who I am. We've reached the end of our time this week on Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. We'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.